Don't leave your best girl. I'm dripping with diamonds and I'm studded with pearls and I'm here. This gal is here. Get up, rise and shine. If you're waiting, now's the time, cause I'm here. If it's dry, it'll rain. If it's flooding, it'll stop. We'll light up the dark and we'll drink till we drop. The mountains will move, we'll paint this town red. And if I'm feeling like it, I might even wake the dead, cause I'm here. This gal is here. This town, it's all mine. We'll amaze right on time. Look who's here. Hey everybody, won't you gather round? Roll up your sidewalks, lay your red collars down, cause I'm here. This gal is here. This town, it's all mine. I'm the gal with the shine. Look who's here.
Hello, this is Jen Ramage, and you're listening to KUSP. My guest on the program today is Susan Laurie Parks, a novelist, playwright, songwriter, and screenwriter, too. In 2001, she received the MacArthur Genius Grant, and in 2002, she was the Pulitzer Prize winner for drama for her play Top Dog Underdog. She joins us here today to talk about her new novel, Getting Mother's Body, this tragic, comedic, send-up road novel that really reminds us of Faulkner. Our unlikely heroine is Billy Bede, and she needs to strike it rich in a hurry. She's 16, dirt poor, and pregnant. So she steals a truck of a neighbor, leaves Texas for Arizona, and enlists a gang of relatives on this expedition to dig up her dead mother and this legendary buried treasure of hers. Welcome to the program, Susan Laurie Parks.
Thanks for having me. It's fun to hear you talk about it. I started laughing. I'm sorry.
Well, this is a road trip novel, but it's so much more than that. It's really about the conversations family have together.
Yeah.
We heard Willa Mae, yeah. And we heard her in your voice first on that song that opened us up. Mm-hmm. And really, she's the main character in this book. Everyone talks about her in these first-person monologues.
Right.
But she's long dead.
Right.
How did you decide that was how she was going to speak to us?
Well, you know, I've been writing dead characters who speak for a long time. I mean, my first play, which I started writing in 1982. Ooh, long time ago now it sounds. But I started writing it in 1982. It's called The Sinner's Place, and there was a dead person in that play that the characters had to dig up. And then in the death of the last black man in the whole entire world, there are like 12 dead people who are talking. So my dead people have been talking for a long time. And, you know, the mother in this story, Willa Mae, is dead. She not only talks or speaks from the grave, but she sings.
Yeah.
'Cause when she was alive, she wanted to be a singer. And now that she's long dead, she still wants to be a singer. And what do I say? No, just because she no longer respires doesn't mean she continues to aspire, even though she no longer respires.
She does, and so does her daughter. Willa Mae yeah. and Billy Bede are yeah. of the same kind. Willa Mae, when they were young, would take Billy Bede off in her car, spend the whole day out looking for a town that had a good name
right.
or something
right.
hip was going on.
Right.
She'd get to that town,
right.
she'd sing a bit, and
right.
she'd realize it was done over.
Right.
And Billy Bede, I think, is searching for that
yeah.
that treasure, too.
Yeah.
Not only fiscally, of course,
yeah.
but really for
yeah.
what will make her life better.
Right. And I think the mistake that her mother made was that her mother thinks it's something outside of her, a town with a wonderful name, a lover who can really, you know, make her life more exciting. But I think that Billy finds that it's not something outside, you know, even though she goes on a long road trip and all that. She finds something, but it's not quite what she was looking for.
Not at all. Well, let's yeah. set the stage a bit. I mean, this is it's important in its location and I think in its time.
Right.
It's 1963 and it's a little town called Lincoln, Texas, where
right.
really it seems like it's a small town cut off from most big ideas. You know,
mm-hmm.
you mentioned President Kennedy once.
Yeah.
The March on
yeah.
Washington, someone says once.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
other than that, it's all of these families living together trying
yeah.
to get along.
Yeah. Yeah.
Trying to make a go of it. Why did you set it at that time in this kind of barren, dusty landscape?
Yeah. My mom, the book is dedicated to two people. One is Frances Ammon. She spells her name with an I. Excuse me, my mother. So, my mother's a Texan. And my mother's born in East Texas, but when she was a kid, they moved to West Texas. So that barren landscape really comes from a time when we used to visit all of her relatives, and all of her relatives still live in West Texas. And I love West Texas. And I really wanted to sort of embrace that landscape, you know. It's set in 1963 because 1963 was a time when it was, we were still really hopeful in a very beautiful way. President Kennedy was in the White House. It was very exciting. He was an exciting president. He was a Catholic, which people thought was strange. And the March on Washington was on the horizon. So people were looking toward these, you know, a wonderful man in the White House and a March on Washington. And they were kind of looking forward and looking up in a really beautiful way. And so I set it in the summer right before the march, where a couple of people in that town are discussing, yes, you're going to go? Oh, I'm thinking about it. You're going to pack a gun when you go on the road? Oh, I'm thinking about it. You know, those kinds of questions, yeah, how they'll get there and that kind of thing. But yeah, it's not, the novel is not, the trip is not the March on Washington that the people go on. It's actually in kind of the other direction out, yeah, towards Arizona to dig up mother who's been buried with some jewelry, which will bring some money into the family that the family desperately needs.
They're going out west to seek a better future.
Yeah. It's like the treasure of the Sierra Madre.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's two people who I think really embody this kind of looking up and looking forward, mm-hmm, in an optimistic way,
right,
are the people who own the gas station and who Billy Beade lives with since her mother's passing, which are,
right,
of course, Uncle Roosevelt,
right,
and Aunt June. Aunt,
right,
June is someone who lost her leg when she was 16,
yeah,
and still has a hope of getting one as a replacement. And,
right,
and
right,
Uncle Roosevelt is also an interesting character. You know, he,
yeah,
was a preacher,
yeah,
and he lost the voice of God.
Right,
but
right,
but he still stays hopeful. Can you talk about those two?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's questions, and I get nervous because I don't know. I don't think about. Yeah, they. Aunt June and Uncle Roosevelt. They don't have children of their own. They've taken Billy in. Billy is Uncle Roosevelt's niece. Willa Mae was Uncle Roosevelt's brother. His name. He also goes by Teddy. So Uncle Teddy's, his niece is Billy. So Billy lives with them, and they really, they have nothing.
Yeah.
They don't own the gas station where they work. They just work there, and every month the man who owns it, Sanderson, comes in and strides back and forth and checks out the gas station, you know, the receipts and the goods that have been sold and the goods that have not been sold. And he decides whether or not Uncle Teddy and Aunt June should be allowed to continue to run his gas station. And it's kind of so every month, you know, at the end of the month they're on eggshells because this man comes in and kind of looks over their work. Uncle Roosevelt can't read. And he's an illiterate man, but a very wise man who, yeah, was called to God. And then because he was less than kind to his wife, Aunt June, God stopped talking to him. And he hasn't really admitted that.
And they go,
yeah,
with Billy on,
yeah,
this trip together.
Yeah, they do. They
and
do.
Along the way, they reconnect with a lot of family.
Right.
But how they start off is surprising. Another main character in the book,
yeah,
Dill Smiles,
right,
is a pig farmer.
Right.
She has a nice new truck. She,
right,
makes a good living.
Right.
And they take her truck and take off.
They
and
do.
She goes off to stop them.
Yeah, they do. Well, they take her truck. You know, the problem is that Billy, our pregnant Billy B, doesn't have a dime, you know, and so she needs to go out and get this money. She needs to go out and dig up her mother to get this money, and she doesn't have any way of getting out there, really, because she doesn't have any money, and she wants to borrow money from Dill. Now, Dill Smiles, the cool thing about Dill, one of the cool things, she's a pig farmer, she's making a good living. She was also the lover, one of the lovers, of Willa Mae. So when Billy was a little girl, Willa Mae lived with Dill Smiles. They lived like boyfriend and girlfriend because Dill is a lesbian who dresses as a guy, and the town knows she's a woman, but kind of lets her live the way she wants to live.
Right. They call her, yeah. She's doing real well, but, you know, yeah. Got a good firm grasp on, you
exactly.
know, himself.
Exactly. Exactly. So they respect her. The town respects her as they would a man. Because she, Dill, does things like she can fix somebody's car. She can help out fix somebody's roof. She's a better shot than most of the men in the town. You know, she can really use a pistol. But they know she's a woman. So Willa Mae and Dill lived together as, you know, girlfriends, lovers, and Billy lived with them. So Billy has a connection to Dill. So when Billy needs money, Billy goes to Dill Smiles to ask Dill Smiles for money. Dill is tight with her money, is really stingy, and doesn't give her anything. So Billy feels like, you know, what the hell? I'm going to steal Dill's truck. So Billy grabs the keys and slips out the door and roars up to her uncle and aunt's place and says, jump in, you know, and they kind of roar off in a stolen vehicle. And, yeah, of course, Dill figures it out the next morning and gets a ride after them, goes down the road after them in a hearse driven by Laz Jackson, who's the son of the funeral director. So there's kind of a chase scene.
Now, and this yeah. is, of course, you know, death going to death, this Hearst image. And you have a right. lot of people in this book and in yeah. your other work yeah. that work in death. Yeah. Laz Jackson, who is sweet on Billaby, though she won't give him the time of day, drives this hearse. His father owns a funeral home. Right. The man who impregnated Billaby
right.
makes caskets.
Yes, custom-made coffins. Not just coffins. There were a lot of African Americans in the funeral business, and there are a lot of African Americans. You know, you just can't have a funeral. You just can't bury somebody. You got to bury them in the manner that speaks to the way they lived. So there's a there are people who make coffins, you know, like in the shape of a guitar or a Cadillac, things like, you know, put special things on the coffin. It's not just a box, you know, it's a special thing. So yeah, so Billy's the guy who got her pregnant is a custom coffin maker who's very good at it, actually. Mm. But Laz is just, he just helps his daddy run the funeral home, and they don't make coffins or anything, and he loves Billy because he sees something in her that she doesn't even see. And he tries to tell his daddy what it is, and his daddy doesn't really think much of Billy, but he loves her, so.
There's a sense here where in this small community of Lincoln, Texas, mm-hmm. no one is afraid of death. It's a part of everyday True. Life and everyday conversation. Mm-hmm. And that's not always the case in American life.
Right, right.
But, of course, it is the case in William Faulkner's As I Lay Dying, right. in a way this book seems like a send-up to that work.
Right.
What are you trying to get at life by facing death?
Well, like in a lot of my plays, I mean, like the America play where they were there's a family of grave diggers, or the death of the last black man in the whole entire world, where there was a whole cast of dead people.
Yeah.
The main character was dead and didn't know. His question was, where do I go? Now that I've died, where do I go?
Yeah.
That was his question. He wandered around the play looking for a resting place and found that at the end of the play, he discovers, of course, that the play called The Death of the Last Black Man in the Whole Entire World is his resting place.
Yeah.
So, yeah, why I do this, I don't know. That was one of the attractions, I think, to the Faulkner novel for me, is that when I read that book a long time ago, I realized, oh, he's into dead people too.
Yeah.
You know, and that was the first book I read of his, so of course I thought that all his books were like obsessed with dead people, you know.
Just all of yours.
Yeah, right. I was projecting, but I thought, wow, you know, he's into the dead too. Yeah. I just think it's a part of life, and it's something that the characters, the more they embrace that aspect of their reality, the more successful they are in this book, certainly. Laz, who is a digger, a grave digger, which also rhymes with the word N-I-G-G-E-R,
right.
which is a joke I've been telling myself for a long time. But he is a hero in the book because he can dig.
Yeah.
Just like in Venus, the Negro Resurrectionist is kind of the hero in the book because he is a digger. Certainly the America play, the heroes are the ones who can dig the hole that needs to be dug.
Complete the work.
Yeah, complete the work. So,
well, this is a story, of course, that at its core sounds like this road novel, and mm-hmm. they're going towards something, and there's action. As you said, there's car chases. But really, it's a lot quieter than that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You frame the book by having dozens of voices,
mm-hmm.
all somehow related to the beads and their daily life.
Right.
And
right.
these chapters are all in first person. They're
right.
all monologues by
right.
these characters.
Right.
And some are 2 pages long.
Right.
And you hear these people just mm-hmm. jump off the page.
Right.
How did you decide you wanted mm-hmm. to put it in a book instead of on a stage?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I knew that it was a novel. I knew that I was going to use my years of playwriting to help me write it, so the voices. And I knew that drawing from, again, from Faulkner, but also from Virginia Woolf with The Waves, I knew that writing in voices was a legitimate way to write a novel. So as a playwright, I could use that way to at least enter into the world of novel writing. But, you know, there's things that a novel can do or that this novel needed to do that it wouldn't really have done very well on stage, and that's the landscape of Texas. You know, Steinbeck said, I think it was Steinbeck, Texas is a state of mind.
Yeah.
You know, okay, so you have this Texas, this landscape of West Texas, and to show it, what are you going to do? Put some road dust on the stage, you know,
yeah.
or some slides or one of those cycloramas or, you know, that kind of
yeah.
thing, and project images of Texas. That wouldn't do it. I really wanted to have Texas, the idea of Texas, bloom in the mind of the reader.
Yeah.
Okay? So the reader creates Texas in her or his mind. Also, I wanted to give the characters room to think,
yeah.
to muse, to gnaw on various ideas. There are lots of, I say big in quotation marks, big ideas. These are unschooled people who don't have much education, but they have a lot of notions about the world in which they live. And I wanted to give them room to ruminate on those notions. In a play, you know, Hamlet says, you know, suit the action to the word, you know, so we're always marrying the action, the activity with the dialogue or monologue. A soliloquy talking aloud is very different from thinking,
yeah.
you know, with your lips closed
yeah.
and just thinking. It's a very
watching
different,
everyone.
Exactly. It's a very different activity for the character,
yeah.
you know. When the mouth opens and the words start to issue forth, it's different. They change when they hit the air. So to have just the thoughts circling in the mind of the character, when Billy says she's trying on her wedding dress, she's in a wedding shop and she's trying to buy a dress, and she's 5 months pregnant, and she's trying on the dress, and she says, I talk to my baby without opening my mouth. Be small, baby, be small. That's not
yeah.
to be said aloud.
No.
It is.
And she wants that because she wants to fit into this gorgeous dress.
Exactly. So yeah. she's thinking it. These are her thoughts. Roosevelt has some thoughts when he goes to the place, when on their journey they pass through the town where Roosevelt and June used to live, where Roosevelt had a church, an actual structure. And Roosevelt goes to the land, and the land is bare. The church has been torn down. And he stands there with his arms wide apart. He cannot exactly remember where the church used to be, the actual structure. So he has not only lost the sound of God's voice, but he has lost the memory of the structure, the memory of the placement of the structure. And this really totally breaks his heart. That's something that he just needs to have running around in his mind. It's not something that he needs to speak aloud and act out on yeah. a stage.
And in fact, he doesn't even share it with his wife.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
It is not. These are things that are important that go on in the characters' minds, but unspoken.
And it's this intimacy that we share with them.
Just like the mother under the layers of earth.
Yeah.
We're very intimate with her, but we don't hear her. You know what I mean? So it's weird. It's really weird. But it's a great way to get really close to the character, to walk around inside their, not just their shoes, in their whole body. You know, I mean, getting mother's body is not just a joke about, it's not just like going to dig up the mother. Mm-hmm. It's not just about the joke about, oh, we're all afraid, men and women alike, we're going to become our mothers, you know. But it's also getting into not only mother's body, but the bodies of the other characters. What is it called? The transmigration of the soul before death. You know, Joyce talked about that, or other people too, I guess, Aristotle or Plato or one of those guys. You know, how the soul moves from body to body after death. But I think in this novel, it's before death we are allowed to visit these bodies.
God, and Willa May is perfect.
Yeah.
Linkage to all of these
yeah,
people.
Yeah.
Well, Susan Laurie Parks, let's hear a little bit from one of these characters. Let's hear Billy Beed and how she got in all this trouble.
Well, yeah, this is from the very beginning of the book. And Billy is, I think it's pretty clear. Billy's got the first chapter. "Where are my panties at?" I asks him. Snipes don't say nothing. He don't like to talk to me when he's in the middle of it. "I think I lost my panties," I says, but Snipes ain't hearing. He got his eyes closed, his mouth smiling, his face wet with sweat. In the middle of it, up there on top of me, he's going in and out. He's not on top of me, really. He's more like on top of the side of me, 'cause he didn't want my baby belly getting in his way. He didn't say so. He didn't say nothing about the baby yet, but I seen him looking at my belly, and I know he's thinking about it somewhere in his mind. We're in the back seat of his Galaxy, a Ford. Bright lemon-colored outside, inside the color of new butter. My head taps against the door handle as he goes at it. "Huh, huh, huh," Snipes goes. In a minute my head's gonna hurt, but it don't hurt yet. "Where?" I go, but he draws his fingers down over my lips, hushing them so I don't finish. Then he rubs my titty, moving his hand in a quick circle like he's polishing it. I try scooching down along the seat, away from the door, but when I scooch, Snipes is going at it, scooches me right back up again against the door handle. I wonder if my baby's sitting inside me upside down, and if Snipes's thing is hitting it on its head like the door handle is hitting me on mine's. "Ow," I go, 'cause now my head hurts. "Ah," Snipes goes, 'cause now he's through. He lays there for a minute, then pulls himself out of me and gets out of the car. He closes up his pants while he looks down the road, zipper, then belt. In my head, I can see all the little seeds he just sowed in me, all them little Snipeses running up inside me, looking for somewheres to plant. But there's a baby up in me already, a baby Snipes. Baby Snipes knocks down the little Snipes seeds as fast as they come up.
That's the start of Billy Beed's journey. And it is at first this idea that you can't escape Beedism, which is this family's inability to get better in life. And their fate is always to fall.
Right.
Willa May had Billy out of wedlock.
She did.
And here's Billy Beed at 16 with Snipes.
Right.
But really, this is a transcendent novel. Beedism does change.
Well, thank God you can't escape. Gosh, I'm talking. Thank God you cannot escape Beedism. Because the character's name, Bead, came from, I do a lot of yoga and we have those things, it's Santa Cruz, people know what I'm talking about, malas, you know, those necklaces with the beads, the seeds on them. And I wanted a name for a family that would be like, it mirrors the pearls, you know, the necklace, the pearl necklace that the mother is buried with.
The treasure.
Exactly. So they do, the Beeds do want to escape their Beedism because it's a life of hard life, no luck, you know, poor, eating with your hands, no table manners, no schooling, missing teeth, missing legs, pregnant girls, going out to Arizona to dig up a body. You know, it's kind of a wacky life. But I think towards the end, they realize that what one of them says on the road, family is fortune. And so I'm you know, they don't escape their Beatism. I think that's a good thing.
That's right. They just reconnect with it.
Right, right.
Well, Susan Laurie Parks, thank you for bringing us this family.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
You're welcome.